Time now for revolutions per minute.
Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live from the new WBAI studios. We're a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and New York City, its biggest chapter. We're run by our 9,000-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. I'm Bernard Goyder. Tonight, we're joined live from New Jersey by Chigozie Onyema, who is running for city council in Newark. We'll also be speaking to Rebecca Martinez and Julian Mestri from the Radical Theatre Collective about their production of Songs About Trains. First, we're going to move to the headlines with Amy Wilson.
This is Amy Wilson with your headlines for today, Wednesday, April 20th. In local news, a legal unit at the NYC Commission for Human Rights that investigates housing discrimination claims no longer has any active staff after the city agency repeatedly failed to fill its vacancies. New York City's public advocate Jumani Williams and city council member Rafael Salamanca of District 17 propose a homeless bill of rights that would list all the services to which unhoused New Yorkers are entitled in a single document. Though it won't create new laws to protect the homeless, it would lay out their rights, including access to bathrooms and laundry facilities. City Council grilled the Mayor's Office of Climate and Environmental Justice about its plans in the event of a major storm. However, nearly a decade after Hurricane Sandy, the office continues to delay sharing such plans and instead continues to wait for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers report, which won't be available in its final form for years. New York City's Rent Guidelines Board is considering approving rent hikes as high as 9% on rent-stabilized apartments in the city. New York State prison officials have been blocking most requests for medical release before they ever reach the parole board with little or no explanation. Mayor Eric Adams proposed adding 100 seats for kindergartners and 1,000 seats for third graders to the city's gifted and talented program in public schools while eliminating the admissions test. Under his proposal, pre-K teachers would nominate students for a lottery to gain access to the program. Starting Thursday, adults in New Jersey will be able to legally purchase recreational cannabis at approved medical marijuana dispensaries. Political scientist Susan King explained to the New York Times that last Tuesday's mass shooting in the subway system demonstrates that increased police presence neither correlates with nor causes decreased crime. A gay married couple has filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to say that the city discriminated against them based on sex and sexual orientation when the city's employee insurance plan refused to cover their in vitro fertilization. Since neither member of the couple fit the city's definition of, quote, infertile. An arbitrator ruled that two Buffalo police officers who pushed a protester to the ground during protests after the murder of George Floyd, leading to his hospitalization for head injuries, were, quote, legitimate. A grand jury had decided a year ago not to indict the officers for felony assault. The Civilian Complaint Review Board found that of 181 NYPD officers known to have lied during internal investigations, Not a single one was fired for it, despite it supposedly being a fireable offense. Only 5 faced any discipline at all. New bail laws passed in New York State's budget increase the number of crimes for which defendants can be required to pay bail. And in elections news, Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin resigned after being indicted for campaign finance fraud. A Harlem real estate developer collaborated with investigators to help expose Benjamin's false dealings. Democratic leaders in Albany are trying to change the law to allow them to remove former Lieutenant Governor Benjamin from the ballot in this year's Democratic primary election. New York City's Campaign Finance Board is investigating several independent expenditure committees, including Amplify Her and 1199 for Maya, for failing to disclose donors during the city's 2021 election cycle. Rep Your Block has accused the Brooklyn Democratic Party of forging signatures on ballot petitions. This concludes tonight's headlines. Now back to you in the studio, Lee, for tonight's show.
Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by the NYDSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethornnyc.substack.com. And we're joined here by Chigozie from New Jersey. Chigozie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, doing very well, thank you. It would be great to learn a bit about the campaign you're running for Newark City Council over in New Jersey. And just perhaps to kick things off, Do you want to maybe talk a bit about what made you decide to run for Newark City Council?
Yeah, so I'm running for City Council in Newark's West Ward. It's a fairly competitive race. The current incumbent, he's not running for re-election because I was just listening to the headlines about Brian Benjamin, because he also got in trouble some time ago. But one of the challenges that I've seen, not only in the West Ward, but really in some of the sort of outer wards of Newark, is that while the city of Newark and downtown was growing and developing, a lot of the wards were being left behind, right? And so one of the things that I thought was that, you know, we needed some leadership to bridge that gap between the two Newarks, and we also needed some creative ideas. And really, I thought our city council didn't have enough folks out there who were thinking creatively about some of our challenges, whether they be public safety, whether they be economic development, or just really improving the quality of life of the city. So I decided to throw my hat in the race, and, it was also an extension of some of the organizing work that I've been doing.
Yeah, one of your campaign priorities you said there is public safety. What do those words mean to you?
Yeah, I think public safety means a lot of things. I think oftentimes when we think about violence, we only think about physical violence. And I think the physical violence is, you know, certainly important. I think people need to feel physically safe. But for us, it's not only being safe physically, but also being, you know, safe from eviction. It's also being safe from a food desert. It's also being able to just meet all of your material needs in the community. And so when we think about how to create a safe community, or what the safest communities look like, I think the safest communities have the most resources. And so what we want to do is really sort of improve the material conditions of people inside the city of Newark so that we can feel safe in every single way. It's not police in our mind that create safety. It's well-resourced communities that do it.
So would you be looking to reallocate some of Newark's $150 million police budget to achieve some of those goals?
Absolutely. I think what we'd like to do even is to sort of deepen democracy when it comes to the police budget, right? So we've been talking quite a bit about what it could look like to do some participatory budgeting, right? So giving residents an opportunity to talk about how they'd like to spend the police budget or the public safety budget, because it's really the folks on these blocks in these communities that can really tell you what it'll take to create safety. And they have a real deep sense of those challenges. So we think including folks in that process would have a really positive effect. So not just reallocating, but actually having residents decide what happens with a portion of that money.
So what else do you think the city government can do to make a material impact on the lives of its residents?
Well, I think that one of the biggest needs in Newark is housing. You know, I think there's a significant affordable housing shortage in Newark. There was one report that said that Newark needs another 16,000 affordable housing units in order to meet its affordability gap. And about 3,500 of those are right here in the West Ward, where we're running for office. So I think the city has some ability to ensure that we improve or increase the number of affordable units that we have. And I think we have to use every tool at our disposal in order to make that a reality.
Are there other ways that you can address the housing crisis in terms of maybe zoning and changing some of that kind of stuff?
For sure. So the city of Newark has an inclusionary zoning ordinance. And what that ordinance does is it says that if you build 30 units or more, you're required to make sure that 20% of those units are affordable. And that requirement only kicks in if you receive subsidy from the city or if you receive a certain kind of zoning variance. And it's important to know that the overwhelming majority of projects will either receive subsidy or a zoning variance. So effectively, if you're building 30 or more units, you will be required to put 20% of the, make those 20% of those units affordable. But the challenge with the inclusionary zoning ordinance in the city is that you can opt out. And when you opt out, you basically have to put a certain amount of money into an affordable housing trust fund. And the problem with that is it's not as if you put $10,000 or $15,000 in an affordable housing trust fund, I can't then take that and build another unit elsewhere. So really what the city needs is to increase the amount of money that you would have to pay in order to opt out. And right now there is some legislation before the city council to do some of that, which I think will have a really good effect. I think the opt out is being increased from like a, you know, 20 or 30K to like 180K. That's what's proposed in the bill right now. I don't know if the city has enough votes for it, but I think that's something that would be a good effect in terms of allowing us, one, to either build affordable units inside of those projects that are required to, or creating some money in this affordable housing trust fund to build units elsewhere. And then also reducing the number of units you have to build in order to for it to kick in. So instead of 30 units, making it 15 units. And I know that's a lot of numbers there, but the whole idea is really just using the city's zoning laws in order to build affordable housing.
So how do you balance economic development with racial justice in the neighborhood?
Well, I think it's really difficult. I think that, you know, I think cities across the country are really trying to figure that out, right? So, you know, if you think about a lot of the development that's happening in Newark is really happening because of our proximity to places like New York, which means that Jersey City already experienced some of that development. Hoboken has experienced some of that development. Harrison is experiencing that development now. And Newark is sort of the next stop on the PATH train. And I think that all of those cities have struggled to figure out how to make sure that the people who currently live there and in places like Newark, which is overwhelmingly Black and brown, we've struggled to figure out how to make sure that we actually benefit from that development. And the only real ways that I can think of that we can benefit from it is if we either get a job from it, we get an affordable unit from it, or somehow we own some of what's happening inside that development. So I think that we have to really make sure that, for example, projects that receive subsidy hire Newark residents. I think we have to really be more strict around inclusionary zoning. And I also think we just have to get creative around what it looks like to do development in neighborhoods, right? Community land trust is one of the ways we can get creative to create some permanently affordable housing so that folks aren't just subject to the whims of the market. So I think that there's a couple of ways, but I think we have to get a lot more creative at the city level. And I think if we can be successful at the city level, then we can figure out how to export that either to other cities or to scale up right here in Newark.
Because I guess one of the challenges is that economic development often just benefits the bosses and the landlords rather than the ordinary people.
Absolutely. And I think that when you think about the question of democracy, you know, so Newark has 9 council people, right? And if an ordinance gets passed to 5 council people, we can accept that that was democratic, right? Because there was an election in May. After that election, we elected 9 people, and those 9 people are supposed to make some decisions for us or on our behalf. But the problem with the economy is that you have an unelected group of people that are making decisions about what the future of our economy. And I think that, to me, that's fundamentally unjust. So really, I think part of what we have to do is to shift the narrative of what it means to be a democratic society and make sure that we have democracy at all levels, right? So we have democracy in our workplace, we have democracy in our electoral politics, and most importantly, we have democracy in our economy. And I think that's the ultimate challenge, I think, of our generation.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about the role that DSA has played in your campaign.
DSA has been extremely helpful. So DSA was, I want to say, the first entity to endorse us, and it's the North Jersey chapter of DSA. They were the first entity to get behind us and endorse us, and that was critical. And their endorsement wasn't just like a paper endorsement, right? So DSA came out in mass. We've had days of action in March and April, really throughout the entire campaign. And since DSA has endorsed, they've really given us some of our biggest canvassing days. And so that's been really exciting. But also just talking to them about what the future of Newark ought to look like. I mean, I think folks they've been involved in campaigns in Jersey City, and many of them just have just some really good insight from organizing in unions or organizing in different spaces. So I think it's helped us sharpen some of our policy platforms as well. So DSA has been honestly incredible for us.
Yeah. And I think you're in an interesting place politically because you're sort of up against the local political machine in a sense, right?
Absolutely. We're up against a very strong mayor. Raz Barak is fairly strong. And I think also he has a reputation of being progressive. He's run as a progressive. He's won elections as a progressive. And so when we're trying to run in a West Ward against the candidate that he's endorsed, you know, claiming the progressive mantle isn't always easy. So it's been a unique race in that sense.
Yeah. I want to move on now to the fact that it's obviously 420 today, which for any stoners out there is an important day of the year. What's the situation in New Jersey and in New York currently? We're kind of going through this decriminalization revolution in a sense. How are things over in Jersey for in relation to marijuana?
Yeah, I want to say that there's a referendum that was passed maybe a few years ago. And I want to say tomorrow is the first day that you can sell legal marijuana in New Jersey. So I think there's about maybe a half a dozen dispensaries that are going to be allowed to begin selling. So in New Jersey, you know, we have decriminalized it. We don't know what it quite looks like yet to sell recreational marijuana because tomorrow's the first day. But the question around how it impacts racial justice, you know, it's an open question. You know, for us, you think about the fact that Black folks are probably three times as likely as their white counterparts to get arrested for marijuana possession. So when you legalize it, you deal with some of that. But, you know, now who gets to own, who gets the licenses, who owns the dispensaries, and who benefits from an economy that Black people were, you know, thrown in jail for. So I think we have a lot of work to do to make sure that, you know, there's a racial justice component that's meaningful.
Yeah. And has the policing changed as a result of that referendum?
Yes. I mean, it's supposed to have, right? So you're no longer, I believe there was some sort of attorney general guidelines that said that you could no longer arrest people for marijuana possession. So, so that's changed very specific to marijuana possessions, but you know, there's a range of other drugs that I'm sure, it hasn't changed for. And also just in general, I think that, you know, policing has really been, you know, been fairly racist, not only in New Jersey, but around the country. So, you know, we can put one in the win column for marijuana, but I think ultimately policing has, you know, functioned as a racist institution, and I don't know that it's changed much.
One of your neighboring cities, Camden, took a pretty drastic step in 2013 and dissolved its police department. Do you think that's something you would look at implementing in Newark, or do you think that's not the answer there?
Oh, absolutely not. Camden didn't, you know, there's a narrative out there that Camden somehow abolished their police. They didn't. What they did was, instead of having a local police force, they have a county police force. And a county police force effectively serves the same function as the local police, except there's no local control. And when you think about a city like Newark, overwhelmingly Black and brown city with a Black mayor. And if you think about allowing the county to sort of own the police or manage the police function, I don't know if that's progress. So I'd certainly rather it be locally controlled. I'd rather a Newark mayor pick the public safety director with the consent of an elected city council before we have a county police force that's imposed on us. So I think there's a lot more made of what happened in Camden than there should be.
Yeah. And what do you make of the kind of unionization drive that's happening, particularly with Amazon workers? I know there's a lot of like logistics businesses in your area, and are you kind of following closely what's happening over in Staten Island?
Yeah, man, I was really excited. I'm going to say that the brother who led it is it Chris Smalls, I think.
Yep.
He's from Newark, if I'm not mistaken, or at least he's lived in Newark at some point in his life. Yeah. So I was really excited about it. I think it's one of the biggest labor victories we've seen in our generation, and I hope it's a sign of things to come. I know we have some really big warehouses in New Jersey. And there's also a push, I think, to put something inside Newark Airport. I forget what it's, I don't know if it's a, it's quite a warehouse. It might be something a little bit different, but there's a push to put it in the airport, and there's some pushback from organizations like Make the Road. And I want to say the Iron Mountain Community Corporation as well. So I plan on getting involved in some of that. In fact, have some conversations set up in the coming weeks about what that looks like. But I'm hopeful that, you know, that the unionization spreads. I'm interested to see if, the Amazon labor union partners with another labor union, a more traditional one, to figure out the next steps. I want to know if they're able to get a contract, and you know, so it's something I'm excited about. I'm following it a little bit, and I hope it's a harbinger of things to come.
Yeah, I mean, what are the big unions that represent people in your area then?
I'd say the biggest unions are probably the you know, you have Communication Workers of America. They're the they represent government workers. You have 32BJ, which represents the property managers, the folks who work inside of residential units. You have the building trades, of course. They run the gamut, the carpenters, the electricians, and all sorts. You have the laborers. So I'd say there's a lot of the public sector unions that are really strong, the NJEA teachers unions. And then you also have the building trades, and the building trades tend to be a little bit more conservative. And then the public sector unions tend to be a little bit more progressive, though. That isn't always hold true.
Yeah. What would you be the kind of, what are the first things that you'd do if you win this election?
Oh man, the first thing I would do, I think really, man, I really want to dig in and rebuild some of these Black associations, man. I talked a little bit earlier about what it could mean to deepen democracy. I think some of that starts with having some strong Black associations and neighborhood associations. Cause you know, you talk about 65,000 residents in a ward, but I think if we can build a strong Black club coalition or build some strong Black associations, I think, you know, you can really deepen democracy at the ground level there. So I think really getting my mind wrapping my mind around some of that, and then dealing with some of the vacant and abandoned lots in our city. You know, the West Ward of Newark experienced the foreclosure crisis at a much more significant rate than any other part of the city, and so you really still have a lot of abandoned homes or vacant lots that are owned by the banks or owned by the city of Newark or owned by different entities. So I think really trying to get some of those back on the tax rolls, but also trying to make sure the current residents have access to either to owning them or to occupying them. And then, you know, with some of the city owned land, really figuring out how we can build some community land trusts. I think that a community land trust strategy is also another way we can deal with the affordability challenge in the city of Newark.
One of the things that struck me about your resume, Chigozie, is that you ran for a school board when you were 18 years old, yeah. fresh out of high school. So that's what was that like?
Oh, man, it was an incredible experience, man. I ran because in Maple South Orange, it's a tracking system. And the tracking system, you know, purported to organize students by ability, but it ultimately organized students by race. So by the time you get to sixth grade, you get a letter in the mail. And that letter lets you know whether you're in the top level, upper middle, lower middle, or standard. And oftentimes, Black children were placed in lower middle and standard while the white students were in top classes. And so by the time I get to high school, you know, when you can look into a classroom and based solely on a racial demographic, you can tell which level it was. You know, we really began to ask some harder questions. And I had this phenomenal teacher who's now a professor at Rutgers, Miss Cooper. And, you know, she said, you know, the world is a result of certain people's imagination. We can imagine something different, right? And so I said, well, how do we imagine something different in these classrooms? And she had suggested that said that, you know, you'd have to run for the school board. That's where those decisions are made. Now, I'd never even heard of the school board. Right. So I didn't know what it was. I didn't know that it existed. I think I might have heard of a superintendent before because he might have came to the high school before. But I couldn't really wrap my mind about who or what that was.
You probably knew Shamans from The Simpsons, right?
right. And so eventually, man, we decided that being a good friend of mine, Bill Gifford, who's been also tremendously helpful in the campaign, and who actually had run a year before I'd run, for many of the same reasons, we decided to run together for the school board seat. And, you know, we got endorsed by the New Jersey Education Association, the largest teachers union in the state, but we did come up short. You couldn't have told me at the time we weren't going to win, but we did come up short. But one of the things that I learned is that when you fight, you win, even if it doesn't happen right away. Because we did make some significant changes. I mean, the tracking system, though it still exists, it doesn't exist in the same way. So students aren't tracked in sixth grade. In some cases, they aren't tracked until high school, which I think is progress because it at least lets us know that there's something wrong with the tracking system. And we had a racist principal who was seeking tenure, and we were able to oppose her tenure, and she didn't receive it. The superintendent at the time, he retired at the end of his contract. So I think we made some noise and made some changes, but, you know, there's still a long way to go.
And was there kind of civil rights litigation that came out of that process as well?
Absolutely. So eventually there was a case that was settled, I want to say last year or so. The Black Parents Workshop settled a case around the tracking system. And so, you know, there was certainly an acknowledgement there as well that Black students were having a fundamentally different experience inside of the school system. And there's supposed to be some changes made. What those changes look like, I don't believe that they're committed to getting rid of the tracking system, but I guess I'd have to take a look at the settlement to see exactly what it does. But
and this is a time. This is a time when there's just unprecedented politicization of education. Are you seeing that particularly in Jersey in terms of just certainly maybe not so much in Newark, but certainly in more conservative parts of the state? I imagine things are very intense at the moment.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been reading some headlines around sex education and what that means. it's not something that's big in the city of Newark, but like you said, I mean, it's something that folks are talking about statewide, and I'm sure nationally. There's been these talks about what is it, critical race theory, as if somehow we actually teach critical race theory in schools. But you know, there's a whole bunch of politicization around it. And even just, I think the Zen Education Project often talks about teaching Reconstruction and have this sort of a push to sort of erase that from our memories. And so this sort of white nationalist effort to take over our school system, I think, is going to have some significant ramifications if we don't push back.
Do you think that culture war sort of took Governor Phil Murphy by surprise a little bit during his re-election campaign?
I think it did. I mean, I think it took all of us by surprise a little bit, because I think that, you know, I don't know if we appreciated the extent to which it would affect that governor's race. I think most folks looked at polling and saw that Phil Murphy was pretty far ahead and it was going to be a sleepy race. And I think people expected to win. And I think if you look at the numbers, you know, Democrats came out in decent numbers. It's just that the culture wars really motivated Republicans. And I think that we didn't appreciate how that would happen. But, you know, we really should have when you look at what was happening around the country. Right? There's always a backlash. And I think many of us were kind of surprised at how close it was. And really, you know, Phil Murphy's race is one thing, but the Senate president, Steve Sweeney, losing his reelection effort, I think that's the biggest upset I've ever seen in electoral politics. He's probably, you know, some would argue he was the most powerful Democrat in the state. And he
it was like a truck driver or something that didn't really campaign as well.
Absolutely. It was a truck driver who just ran on the Republican side, who, you know, I think he raised 5 or 10K. And you're talking about the most powerful elected official or one of the most powerful elected officials in the state. And he lost. I mean, so I think the pendulum definitely swung in South Jersey, and the culture wars really had its impact. And I think in 2025, in the next election, I think we're going to be really confronting that as well. So I think we have to stay vigilant. I don't think, I don't think that any of these sort of statewide Democrats are the most progressive folks, but I think we have to hold on to the gains that we've had. So I think we have to be thoughtful about how we approach these statewide races as progressives.
Fantastic. Chigozie Onyema, thank you so much for joining us on Revolution Per Minute. Today. It's been great to have you, and best of luck with your campaign. Is there anything else you want to add just while we've got you, in terms of details of the polling day and anything like that?
Absolutely. Election day is May 10th. Polls open from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. It's Tuesday, May 10th. And my ballot position for those who live in the West Ward is 5C. If folks want to volunteer, come on down to the city of Newark. Our campaign headquarters are at 989 South Orange Avenue. We're there every evening at around 4 or 5 o'clock. And we're also there every Saturday at 10 a.m. So please do come out and hang out with us.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, brother. Take care.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. You just heard from Chigozie, a North New Jersey DSA-endorsed candidate for West Ward City Council. And up soon, we'll hear from Brooklyn's own Julia Salazar. But first, a reminder that we are only on air because of listeners like you. WBAI is listener sponsored. So if you can, please give to the station. You can call 212-209-2950. Again, that number is 212-209-2950, and shows like Revolutions Per Minute, candidates like Chigozie are only able to get their message out because of listeners like you. So you can go to also give at WBAI.org. Thanks so much to all of our listeners.
Thanks. Now we're going to hear an interview with the collective behind Songs About Trains, which has premiered at the New Ohio Theater downtown off Broadway. I caught up with Rebecca Martinez and Julian Mastery of Radical Evolution to learn more about the project. Songs About Trains.
Involved in the show, but for the development of it for about the past maybe 4 years, including to the pandemic. And really, it came from a love of, like, Beto's love of folk music, particularly the canon of railroad folk songs, which is so large and so massive. Mm-hmm. And both thinking as a playwright, what do we do with this, and how do we tell the stories not just of the music, but also the stories that highlight the workers who those first person accounts of workers are not part of, are just not as accessible. So how to think about who these workers could be and to provide context on the stories, on the songs themselves.
This train I work on is a thousand coaches long. You can hear the whistle blow 100 miles. If this train runs me right, I'll be home Saturday night. I'm 900 miles from my home, and I hate to hear that lonesome whistle blow.
We picked a bunch of songs that we love from, and started thinking about how to talk about stories from five specific cultural communities in this place that is now known as the United States, that were, that both worked on and or were impacted by the building of the railroad. And knowing that those first person accounts are next to impossible to find, we looked and we found that most of the writing that was done around that time that is not in song form, any sort of first person account, has it was more in the voice of the people in power as opposed to the workers. And it was very important for us to be able to highlight the voices of workers. And because it was hard to find, one of the things that we came up with the idea of getting together five writers to write letters.
There's 57 of us Irish boys out here, and we are digging into solid rock. Duffy says we got the hardest section, he's for sure not lying. I'm saving every penny I can manage, and I'll send you money just as soon as I make sure you get to rock. Show me.
Started to bring in these different narratives and stories. One thing we didn't want was to make sure that not all the songs we play from each section belong to that particular ethnicity, but rather, like, how can we have, you know, a Cantonese folk song be used to comment and think about this Irish character's experience and things like that. And so we really were trying to find a way for the music to kind of be the thread that connects the different communities as well.
I mean, there were some songs that was like, we love this song, but we're going to say goodbye to it. And then there's some songs that we knew had to stay in, had to stay in, because the love was too great. We couldn't let go of them. But then we thought a lot about, like, that. Like, what is the tone doing? What are the lyrics doing? What is the feel? How do we think about adjusting the feel throughout? So it is it is an emotional and musical narrative.
Was Casey Jones one of those songs?
Yes. Casey Jones is one of those songs.
Yeah, Casey Jones go nowhere.
And we tried lots of versions of Casey Jones because we had, you know, the unionization and strike is a serious topic. It's a very serious topic, and people have lost their lives. Like, people have been threatened in many, many ways. And that song is so upbeat. And we tried and we tried and we tried many different iterations of, like, is there a sad Casey Jones? Is there a lower tempo Casey Jones? And then we ended up embracing, like, nah, we just got to do Casey Jones as Casey Jones. And I think that this version of the text that helps get us into the idea of strike has been one that leads us to a moment of collective shout and cheer that I feel like is exactly what that song wants to, that the space that song really wants to hold. Like, it is about the collective power, as opposed to here's a moment of sadness. It is about a moment of power from people.
It's a goofy song. There was actually that variation of the Casey Jones, I believe, was written by an IWIW striker, right? You know, to do that, and I think it makes its point quite effectively in that context.
The worker said to Casey, won't you help us with the strike? But Casey said, let me alone, you better take a hike. Then someone put a bunch of railroad ties across the track, and Casey hit the river with an awful crack.
Things that I would hope is that it does make people really reflect on this moment, and that they, when they hear about, you know, stories about, you know, like what is happening at Amazon, what is happening with, like, Starbucks, for example, and other places where we're seeing, you know, attempts to unionize, to better the lives of so many people, that they would kind of see the parallels. At least that's my hope. And I think that a big thing in it too, both from a point of view of someone who helped create this piece, but also thinking about the larger goals of this performance collective that we've created, Radical Evolution, is that, you know, we really do believe that, like, solidarity is really important, and we really do believe that, like, people that come from different places have a lot in common if they start to look, you know, and they really start to think about it. And I, you know, it's not lost on me that we're doing a show about labor in a downtown theater, and that we're doing it largely for a downtown theater community, which is a very specific population of a population in New York, you know. And I hope that, you know, that community, and in particular, you know, I think a lot about the artists who are in unions, right, and that are involved in this show and that come to see it, think about, like, how they can create moments of solidarity with people like Amazon workers, like Starbucks workers, like people at SEIU, you know, like, that they can start to see the parallels between their lives.
Songs About Trains can be seen in person and streamed live through Saturday, April 23rd. It's at the New Ohio Theater. You can find out more information about the show at newohiotheater.org.
State Senator Julia Salazar was the first New York City DSA endorsed elected to head to Albany in 2019. She has now gone through three state budgets, a process once dominated by three men in a room, referring to Governor Andrew Cuomo and previous leaders of the Assembly and Senate. I talked to Julia earlier today about why she voted no on the 2022 New York state budget and what her expectations were for the budget with Cuomo gone. Here's what she had to say.
The budget this year, I was hopeful about having a new governor who seemed at first to be more willing to work with legislators to try to achieve some shared goals. I was pretty optimistic going into the budget process, but we learned pretty quickly during the budget process that our expectations, unfortunately, would not be met, and that really the governor, or new governor, was operating very similarly to Governor Cuomo and how Governor Cuomo always operated in the budget process with the outsized power that the governor has. And I think it really demonstrates for us that the problem fundamentally with the budget process in New York State is not just about, in fact, not primarily about the person in power in the governor's office, but really it's more about the systemic problems in the budget process, that it is like this by design. It is by design opaque. There's a complete lack of transparency, and the power is truly concentrated first and foremost in the governor's hands, but it's really between the governor and the two leaders of the legislative bodies making decisions that have a profound impact in the lives of everyday New Yorkers across the state and determining a massive state budget of about $216 billion. It's a process that we really need to change, but it's going to take a lot of work to change it, including even amending the state constitution in order to make the process more equitable and more transparent.
And yeah, so what ended up happening, after this whole opaque process? Were there good things in the budget? What was bad about it? Yeah, what happened?
What happened? So there were some, right? I mean, in some ways, I'm still asking myself that, only because it happened so quickly. It went from us being hopeful about what we may be able to win in this budget. In the budget process, both houses, the Assembly and the Senate, put forward what are called our respective one-house budgets, our proposals for what the final budget should look like, and they come after the governor puts forth her executive budget. So that happened in around early March. But then a couple weeks after that, when budget negotiations were really beginning, the governor's office leaked a 10-point public safety plan that really boiled down to rollbacks to important criminal justice reforms, bail reform, discovery reform, raise the age, and proposals that would lead to the expansion of the criminalization of poverty, more people, especially people of color and low-income New Yorkers, facing incarceration and being controlled by the city and the state. And so that was really alarming. And that was, I think, a pivotal moment in the budget process, when it went from what seemed like an opportunity to negotiate in good faith and win some good policy victories that were actually relevant to the budget. It went from that, you know, situation to then a situation where we really, all of our capacity was being spent on defending criminal justice reforms. So That really was disappointing. And thankfully, because there was opposition, not only from those of us who are socialists in office, but also from this broader coalition of people who really believe in transforming our carceral system and criminal legal system, there was opposition that was able to prevent that full harmful public safety plan from being included in the final budget, although some of the elements of it, particularly when it came to changing the bail laws, were included in the final budget. And that was why, I mean, that was only one of the reasons why I actually voted no on the budget, and my comrades did as well. There was a proposal in the budget to give away hundreds of millions of public state dollars to the billionaire owner of the Buffalo Bills NFL football team to build a stadium in Western New York, something that was they tried to sell it as, you know, an economic development project that would bring jobs. But the reality is that this is not true economic development. It really is a handout to the wealthy. And it comes in the context of a budget, of a state budget. It really comes at the expense of our communities that desperately need investments of the same magnitude in things like housing and climate justice. Right. And so that was also another very disappointing part of the budget that we fought back hard to try to prevent. There were certainly some victories in the budget, things that are good for our communities. There was a robust investment in child care statewide. It isn't universal child care, but it is a step in the right direction. There also was an investment in increasing the minimum wage for home care workers, which is huge. These are green jobs, jobs that should be quality jobs because there is such an enormous demand for home care and long-term care in New York, and we're facing a home care crisis. We really need to be paying home care workers dignified wages, and that isn't the reality right now at all. Home care workers are earning poverty wages. And so we did see an increase in the minimum wage for home care workers, although it really was a fraction of what we were demanding. So while it's an improvement and we can't deny that, working people really deserve so much more than what this budget provided.
Yeah. And then the handout to the fracking billionaire, you know, it's like not only is he a billionaire, but like he made his money fracking Pennsylvania. It's rough.
Absolutely. Yeah. And actually, just to add one more point that's relevant to what you just mentioned, Lee, the revenue bill within the state budget, which actually is comprised of 10 different bills, in the revenue bill, they also included a gas tax holiday. And we know that is really bad public policy. We should not be incentivizing people to use fossil fuels if we don't need to do that, and we don't need to do that. I understand, of course, that there are a lot of working people across the state who don't live in New York City or places that have really reliable public transit, and some people need to rely on cars to get around. But the appropriate response in order to alleviate the economic pressure that some families are facing from high gas prices is not a gas tax holiday.
Yeah. And a couple weeks ago, you know, we didn't have a show last week, but the week before when the budget was still almost out, but, you know, we were pretty sure that a lot of the, you know, policy that environmentalists were fighting too, the All Electric Buildings Act, which Assemblymember Gallagher is the prime sponsor of, and the Build Public Renewables Act, which, you know, members of eco-socialists have been fighting very hard for, you know, had been taken off of the table. So yeah, it's disappointing to see that those things that people, you know, were willing to get arrested for were not on the table, yet a gas, you know, holiday, a gas tax holiday is. So kind of, you know, and I think what a lot of people don't know too is how much space the budget takes up. Like, electeds won't talk to you about other bills because of the budget. And now we have a very, very short time. You all get sent home for the summer, June 2nd. So, you know, what are socialists in office kind of fighting for and hoping to pass in the next 6 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned two bills that are very high priorities for the socialists in office and for others who are working with in coalition in the legislature. The Build Public Renewables Act, we still can pass the BPRA outside of the state budget, and I think that it's urgent that we do that. So that's still going to be a major focus for us in these final 6 weeks, as well as the All Electric Building Act. We know that the construction industry and building industry is, if not the number one, the number two biggest source of fossil fuel use of pollution in our state. And it really would go a long way for us to pass the All-Electric Buildings Act and make this really strong commitment to transitioning away from fossil fuel use. We also really are focused on passing good cause eviction legislation, a bill that I've sponsored for the past few years that would expand protections from eviction and from unjustifiable rent increases to families across the state who currently have virtually no protection from either of those things or from retaliation at the end of their lease if they were to complain about repairs or conditions in their building. So it's really important. It's our top housing justice priority is to pass good cause eviction. We also want to make progress on immigration justice. In the budget, we had the opportunity to pass what truly would have been coverage for all, expanding access to Medicaid and to healthcare coverage and access to the New York State of Health to people regardless of immigration status, because currently our undocumented neighbors are unable to participate in that, and that's really harmful. We had the opportunity to change that in the state budget, but unfortunately, our state leadership decided that that wasn't a priority for them, and so it didn't happen. That's something that we still need to continue fighting for. But even beyond that, since that really is it has a fiscal impact and it's difficult to do that outside of the budget, what we can do is pass legislation like the New York for All Act, which would protect immigrant New Yorkers from ICE to try to further separate law enforcement in at the city and state level from collaborating with federal immigration enforcement, so that all of our neighbors, regardless of immigration status, can move through the state without fear of immigration enforcement. So that's another really high priority for us. We have a comprehensive legislative platform, but in these final 6 weeks, these are some of the things that we're really focused on trying to win.
Cool. And yeah, are there ways that people can support that? If they're a DSA member, how can they, you know, you guys are playing the inside game. How can people support on the outside too?
Yeah. When it comes to good cause eviction, going on Housing Justice for All's website, housingjusticeforall.org, and learning about the public actions, direct action that Housing Justice for All is taking. There are canvases with DSA's Housing Working Group. Also, not only for good cause eviction, but with the Eco-Socialist Working Group. Making sure that we are spreading the word about the Build Public Renewables Act and the important impact that it actually has in all of our lives. These are ways for us to talk to as many people as possible, talk to our neighbors about these things and mobilize each other to put the pressure on the legislature to do the right thing to pass these bills so that we can actually create these very urgent changes that we need to see.
Cool. Anything else you'd like to say to our listeners today or add?
I would just encourage everyone to get involved in DSA's various working groups, because the working groups are doing extremely valuable work, and it is related directly to the legislative work that we are doing in Albany. It wouldn't be possible for us to be effective and as socialist legislators without this really powerful movement and base of support helping us win.
Yeah, it's been kind of cool to watch that develop over the last few years, you know, covering the campaigns on the ground and then how it actually has been playing out in Albany. So, well, thank you so much for joining us today. Senator Salazar, you're always welcome on RPM.
Thank you so much, Lee. I really appreciate it.
That was State Senator Julia Salazar, and you've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener sponsor WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com, and you can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com. or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Next week, we have a pre-Labor Day special, and RPM comrades will be talking to workers who are close to us in our lives. So don't miss it. Happy 420 New York City. We'll catch you next week.
Joy of resistance. We're sisters of the joy of resistance.
March is Women's cool. History
we
Month,
recording
dedicated
on the back end,
to
so
putting
nobody has
women
to worry
back
about their,
into histories written by men and about men. Every
version.
Thursday in March at 11 a.m., Joy of Resistance will bring you special women's history programming. We will cover the reproductive justice movement that brought a woman of color spin to reproductive rights, black women leaders of the civil rights movement, the FBI assault on the women's movement, the political history of the bra, and how book banning by the right wing is erasing women's history today. And that's only some of it. That's 11 a.m. on Thursdays in March. Women's history as you've never known it.
Yes, and it's there this month too. Joy of Resistance, 11 a.m. tomorrow.
Father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
This is Marcia Pendleton, producer and host of Backstage Stories on WBAI New York. The acclaimed artists Keith Joseph Atkins and Kelly Gerard will join us this week to talk about the Apollo Theater's new Black Fest, a series of newly commissioned works from some of the most exciting voices in the American theater. Join us on Thursday, April 21st at 9 p.m. for this riveting conversation on the next Backstage Stories.
You are still listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM on terrestrial radio and live streaming to the world at www.wbai.org.
Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at wbai.org/donateyourcar. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit wbai.org/donateyourcar.
Greetings and salutations. This is Giovanni Anglin.
And I'm Bastian Nissa. Along with intern Mike, you could catch us live on Thursday from midnight to 2 a.m.
You know what, Bash? Our tagline is that this is the show about nothing.
but it's more than that, right?
That's true. Our conversations could be political, but also comical. We're really just giving our point of view on how we see the world and how it affects us today.
So join us Thursdays at